Diarrhea is extremely common. It's estimated that there's about 2 billion, that's billion with a B as in Bravo, cases per year around the globe. Although in developed countries, it's usually a mild disease with no need for treatment, in the underdeveloped world, it can be a major source of morbidity and mortality. Diarrhea has the cumbersome definition of being more than 200 grams of stool per day. But in a practical sense, that translates into more than 3 not well-formed stools per day. Most patients who have diarrhea will have self-limiting disease. It doesn't require medical care. There's a confusing array of potential causes for diarrhea, and these include...
Have you been to Latin America, Africa, or Asia?
Enterotoxigenic E. coli, Campylobacter, Shigella, Aeromonas, Norovirus, Coronavirus, Salmonella.
St. Petersburg, Russia?
Giardia.
Nepal?
Cyclospora.
Or have you been backpacking, camping, or swimming in a wilderness area?
Giardia.
Did you get sick after eating chicken?
Shigella.
Uncooked food or soft cheese?
Listeria.
Raw seafood?
Vibrio, salmonella, acute hepatitis A.
Despite the dizzying array of potential causes and presentations of diarrhea, fortunately, from a clinician's perspective, the disease can be broken down into simple components so that the approach to the disease can be relatively easy. Hello, I'm Ed Livingston, Deputy Editor of Clinical Reviews and Education for JAMA. In today's Clinical Review podcast, we cover diarrhea. The podcast is based on a review article published in the June 28, 2016 issue of JAMA, authored by Dr. Herbert DuPont from the University of Texas at Houston and considered one of the world's authorities on infectious causes of diarrhea. I also spoke with Dr. Annie Feagins in the GI lab at the Dallas VA Medical Center, and she's an associate professor of medicine at the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. Although there are many potential causes for diarrhea, there's only a handful of ways the various diarrhea-causing diseases can manifest themselves. That's because...
The GI tract has a very limited repertoire.
Did you miss that? This is really important.
The GI tract has a very limited repertoire.
That was Dr. Herbert DuPont, the author of the JAMA Review on Persistent Diarrhea. He makes the point that no matter what's causing the diarrhea, the GI tract can only respond in a limited number of ways. However, from those limited responses, the clinician can pretty much get a general idea of what's going on and determine what the best approach should be. Let's start with a very brief review of GI tract function. Its main function is to absorb nutrients from the outside world. To do so, one has to ingest foods that have those nutrients and break them down into a form so that the nutrients can be absorbed. This requires a great deal of water in the GI tract, and the GI tract secretes about 7 liters of water a day to go along with the 2 liters of water a day the average person ingests, meaning that about 9 liters of water per day travel through the GI tract. Water needs to be conserved so that virtually all of it is resorbed into the body in the distal small bowel and proximal colon. In the end, there's only about 100 to 200 grams of water in the stool every day that people lose. So when something goes wrong, the ability of the bowel to deal with all that water is disrupted, and diarrhea results. The gut's a tube that pushes things through it and absorbs nutrients along the way. As fluid passes by, the sugars are actively transported from the bowel into the blood, along with sodium and chloride. Water just passively goes along for the ride. The water follows the glucose, sodium, and chloride by osmotic actions. One way to get diarrhea is to have a highly osmotic fluid inside the bowel lumen that reverses the flow of water from the blood into the lumen. And that's how bowel preps cause diarrhea. They generally have highly osmotic substances that are not absorbed by the bowel that increase the osmolarity inside the bowel lumen, causing water to flow from the blood into the bowel lumen. Another way to get diarrhea is to just ramp up bowel motility so that the fluid is pushed through before the water can be absorbed. The opposite is done to treat diarrhea. Slow down the bowel with a non-absorbed narcotic like loperamide, and then there's less diarrhea. Diarrhea can also occur because certain enterotoxins interfere with the dynamics of fluid movement across the gastric mucosal surface, causing a watery diarrhea. Diarrhea can also occur when cytotoxins secreted by some organisms destroy the cells of the intestinal mucosal barrier, causing a bloody diarrhea that may be associated with systemic symptoms such as fever. As it turns out, from a very limited amount of information obtained from a patient, one can pretty much figure out what's going on with diarrhea and how you can treat it. When a patient walks into your clinic complaining of diarrhea, what do you ask them first?
So I think one of the first things that's important to know is how long has the diarrhea been going on? And that'll make a big difference in what kind of etiologies you start thinking about. The other big thing you want to know is how severe the diarrhea is. So I think those are the two places I really start, severity and length of illness.
That was Annie Feagins. Those two questions addressed two very important points that you need to know about how to treat diarrhea. First, how severe the diarrhea is. And if it's severe, patients may need to be hospitalized to ensure they get adequate hydration and to avoid hypovolemia. Second, the diagnosis and treatment for diarrhea substantially differs based on its duration.
So when we typically think about diarrhea, we think about it as acute or more chronic, and then there's somewhere in between. I guess you could call that persistent diarrhea. So acute we typically think of as less than 2 weeks, whereas chronic diarrhea is more than 4 to 6 weeks, and persistent is going to be that somewhere between 2 weeks and a month that it's been going on.
So let's take the patient who has the relatively mild diarrhea that has only lasted for less than a week or so. How do you manage that? And even before that, what do you think the probable causes are, or how do you approach that patient?
So in the vast majority of cases, in someone who's having acute diarrhea for just a week, like in the case you said, it's usually self-limited things. So infectious things are going to be the most common cause. Viruses, probably the most common, bacteria some of the time. And then when we start talking about the severity of that diarrhea, that'll help us kind of push us thinking more towards viruses or bacteria, with bacteria causing more severe symptoms within that time frame.
So do you have to establish a diagnosis, or you just treat them empirically? And if you do get a diagnosis, at what point do you pursue that, and how do you pursue it?
Probably most of the patients who have those kind of symptoms don't even come see the doctor. They resolve on their own, and we don't even see them. So the ones that we do end up seeing, as far as how much workup to do, I think we're going to base that on the severity of their symptoms. So if they're having pretty mild symptoms, we'll probably reassure them and have them do supportive measures and not necessarily do any other workup unless it continues or persists. However, in the patients who are having more severe symptoms, we may consider at least looking for bacterial infections that we might want to consider treating.
How would you figure out which bacteria?
So most commonly, we'll be sending stool cultures. If they have risk factors like recent antibiotic use, we may want to look for C. diff.
The bottom line is that the vast majority of acute diarrhea cases are mild. Most of them are caused by viruses and don't require treatment. In fact, they're so mild that most patients don't even seek medical help. But this is where persistent diarrhea becomes very important. That's a very different situation. Remember that persistent diarrhea is diarrhea lasting between 2 and 4 weeks. Most of the patients with persistent diarrhea do require some form of treatment, and in contrast to the situation for acute diarrhea, it's important to establish a diagnosis. We spoke to Dr. DuPont, who summarized the major issues covered in his JAMA review. He starts with asking patients about the 4 clinical features that may be associated with their diarrheal illness. Now, this is for any diarrhea, not just for persistent diarrhea, because, remember, the gut has a limited repertoire for how it can respond to insults. In order to sort out what to do about a patient with diarrhea, clinicians should assess the 4 major clinical features Dr. DuPont emphasizes. They are, 1, the patient's symptoms, such as having vomiting or fever, 2, what the patient's potential exposures to infectious agents might be, 3, where they traveled recently, and 4, the appearance of the stool, meaning the need to distinguish between watery diarrhea and diarrhea that has blood or mucus in it. Dr. DuPont explains how you use this information when assessing either acute or persistent diarrhea.
If you have vomiting, and that's a prominent feature of the disease, there are 2 things that cause that. One are viral agents, and noroviruses are the principal ones, 99% are norovirus. And the other one is Staphylococcus aureus food poisoning, or Bacillus cereus food poisoning, which is seen primarily with rice-type products, staph. It can be anything that a food handler that's colonized by staph has. And how you can tell those apart is if there's an outbreak, the incubation period is 2 to 7 hours versus 24 to 48 hours. And the other thing that allows you to separate them is if the people who have them have fever. If there's fever, this means norovirus, not food poisoning. And, of course, the duration of disease is really allows you to make that differentiation very nicely.
Now, what about seeing blood in the...
Bloody stools get you into a category of Shigella, Salmonella, K. Campylobacter and Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, this organism that produces hemolytic uremic syndrome. Completely different pathogens, and these are bacterial pathogens. And these are the ones that the lab can diagnose very efficiently. So if you got blood in the stool, the first thing I'm going to do is get a stool culture.
Would you treat them empirically before the results come back?
Only if they're very sick, they're toxic, and they have high fever. The Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, antibiotics can actually mobilize the phage of toxin production and make the disease worse. But Shiga toxin-producing E. coli, that's the one from undercooked beef and a variety of other food sources, fever is not prominent in that disease. It's very important. Where Shigella, Campylobacter, and Salmonella can produce 103 degrees in temperature. So if you had bloody stools, I would want to know how sick you are. Do you have lots of fever? Are you toxic in appearance? The answer is yes, I'd start antibiotics. If the answer is no, I'd wait for the stool culture because I don't want to treat Shiga toxin-producing E. coli infection.
What about watery diarrhea? What does that mean when you see that?
Watery diarrhea is everything else. And if it's just watery diarrhea, it could be any of those things. You don't have any differentiation. It could be any of those things. But the one food poisoning that causes strictly watery diarrhea with no vomiting is Clostridium perfringens food poisoning. And the incubation period is a little longer. It affects about 350,000 people in the United States every year. Contrast that with 23 million cases of norovirus infection. So 300,000 or 400,000 Clostridium perfringens, 150,000 Staph aureus, about 23,000 Bacillus cereus infections. Those are, to give you an idea of food poisoning, those are the ones where there's a poison in the food. It's not an infection.
So a little bit of information from a patient about their symptoms, such as whether the diarrhea is watery or bloody, or they have a fever, they're vomiting, or from the duration of the disease, can tell you a great deal about what might be causing it and if a patient needs treatment. Patients who have persistent diarrhea do need a diagnosis, and they usually need some form of treatment. Is there anything characteristic about this diarrhea that's different than acute diarrhea? Is the presentation different? Is the type of diarrhea different? Is the symptomatology different between persistent and acute diarrhea?
No, it is not. And this relates to the fact that the GI tract can really only respond in a limited number of ways to pathogens that attack it. And watery diarrhea, cramps, weight loss are pretty much the kind of thing that you see with persistent diarrhea. There is a percentage of those patients that will have bloody diarrhea, and that's a very important group of those, but most of them just have watery diarrhea.
What about the spectrum of pathogens? Is it different between the two types of diarrhea?
Absolutely, and that's the point of this article. When you're dealing with acute diarrhea, most of it is due to viruses and toxins, and the lab isn't going to be helpful in those cases. Local labs don't look for viruses, don't look for toxins, and we just treat them symptomatically. But when you get to persistent diarrhea, there's a very high frequency of pathogen positivity that you will identify by using the lab. And the lab becomes extremely important in persistent diarrhea. The second point about persistent diarrhea is that parasites become very, very important. Where parasites cause less than 1% of acute diarrhea in most studies, now they're coming up to cause maybe a third of the diarrhea that you see, maybe even higher when you're dealing with persistent diarrhea. So, A, we're going to focus on pathogens that are detectable in persistent diarrhea, and B, we're going to really concentrate on the parasites.
Now, you mentioned four major primary features of acute diarrhea that you look for when you're talking to patients, fever, watery diarrhea, gross blood or vomiting. Are your primary questions any different when you're talking to a patient with persistent diarrhea?
I'm going to ask those questions, but I do not expect to hear the same kind of things. 90% of those patients are just going to say watery diarrhea and abdominal complaints, pain or cramps. A small percent will have fever, and that's going to lead me in the thinking towards bacterial pathogens explaining the persistent diarrhea, and a small percentage will have bloody stools, and that will lead me to either bacterial or amebiasis, one specific parasitic pathogen. So I'm going to ask about those same clinical features, but they're not as discriminatory and not as variable in persistent diarrhea as they are in acute.
In your article, you make the distinction between watery diarrhea and diarrhea that has blood or mucus in it. And yet, in your algorithm, patients with both of these features go down the same testing pathway. Why is that?
If you have bloody diarrhea, that is going to be a bacterial pathogen, probably, unless it's an inflammatory bowel disease or some other reason. And you want to focus on that. If you have watery diarrhea without blood, you still, while parasites are creeping in and going to be major pathogens, still bacterial pathogens are going to be important. Although usually bacterial causes of diarrhea last only a week and not longer than a week, occasionally they last longer. And so you end up doing a stool test in both categories. But I want people to think of them a little bit differently, because the bloody diarrhea is going to take us into a bacterial cause more often, and the watery diarrhea more likely a parasitic cause.
And then with either one of those, then you go on to the testing pathway, which is culture, parasite screen, or multiplex PCR. I think the recommendation was to get a couple of stool samples for various tests, and I think you recommend one stool sample. Do I have it right?
No, not exactly. The article that I wrote earlier in New England Journal looking at acute diarrhea, it was one stool. But in the JAMA paper, we say do one stool, but if you don't find a cause, you will have to do serial stools. And so we say screen with one stool because you may well find it. And don't just set them up for three stools, but if you have a negative test and they continue to have diarrhea, you may have to do serial stools.
The third presenting feature that you have in the algorithm is the development of symptoms while traveling to the developing world. When that's in the history, you recommend going right to azithromycin empirically. Could you explain that?
Yes. Diarrhea that occurs in the United States is bacterial in about 10% of cases. 90% are viruses or toxins. But when you travel, 85% of travelers' diarrhea is due to a bacterial pathogen. So that's half of the reason we treat them empirically. The other half is most of these bacteria that produce travelers' diarrhea are not detectable by routine diagnostic laboratories. If you are fortunate enough to have a multiplex PCR set up, you can detect these pathogens, primarily the diarrhea-producing E. coli organisms. But most people don't have access to those. And so you can't find the pathogen if you do the stool studies. And so most of the patients with traveler's diarrhea, and I can't tell you how many patients I see almost weekly that are just like this. They come back from a trip, they've been sick for 2 weeks, and I say, give them azithromycin, and they call me up saying how appreciative they are. And there's no more cost involved, no studies, because you're not going to be able to detect most of those pathogens in the lab anyway. And so that gets that out of the way. And if they don't respond, then they're just like somebody with persistent diarrhea in the United States.
In your algorithm, you make a point to query patients about abdominal pain. Why is that important?
Well, the reason I brought that out is that I do not want physicians to miss ischemic bowel disease. It worries me that they would be sitting on someone with ischemic bowel and be looking for diagnostic things and not go directly where the money is to evaluate, because this can be a life-threatening process. And so I just wanted to make sure that physicians were worried about that as a separate entity.
One important part of Dr. DuPont's algorithm is a consideration for C. difficile for patients who recently have been hospitalized or received antibiotics. Dr. Feagans explains how she evaluates C. difficile at her hospital.
It's going to be lab specific to your facility. Here, they only do the PCR testing. So the way we order that is just, it's a stool sample. The patient submits a sample. The one thing that the lab is very fussy about is if the patient doesn't have a liquid stool, if it's a form stool, they won't even run the test because it's very unlikely that they're going to have C. diff.
Well, C. diff is complicated. Most of the labs are moving to polymerase chain reaction diagnoses. And PCR does not differentiate between carriers of the bacterium or active infection that needs treatment. That's problem number one. Problem number two is that if you look at antibiotic-associated diarrhea, C. diff explains only about 10, 15, 20% of those cases. So a majority are due to other causes. So if you put those two statistics together, plus the fact that between 5 and 15% of patients in a hospital are carrying C. diff, they've acquired it from the environment with spores. Most of the C. diff tests of stools in diarrhea in the hospital are false positives. And this is a challenge. We don't have a good way to diagnose C. diff. But I think, given all that, if you have a patient with diarrhea in the hospital and you test their stool for C. diff toxins, toxin A and B, by any test that the lab runs, if it's positive, you treat them for C. diff, recognizing you're going to be over-treating. But as I tell doctors in Houston, the good news about treating false positives, those patients aren't going to recur because they don't have C. diff. They'll respond nicely to that treatment. But I think that's the best. Now, in Great Britain, they don't do PCR. They use a two-step test, a glutamate dehydrogenase test, testing the stool, which screens out non-C. diff, so you get rid of it, and then you can test by enzyme immunoassay. And they think this two-step test gives you a more accurate diagnosis, and it does, than what we do in this country. But the testing of C. diff is in evolution. To summarize it, you got a person who develops diarrhea in the hospital, they test positive for C. diff toxins, by the lab test positive, you treat it.
Let's discuss symptomatic treatment. The vast majority of patients who have diarrhea won't need treatment for the diarrhea itself. However, many of them are at risk for hypovolemia. Many patients do need some form of oral rehydration therapy, and this can be administered in a fairly simple way.
There's two things that they all have to do, and that is they have to keep up with fluids and salt, particularly if it's an intense diarrhea with 10 or more bowel movements a day. But we did some studies on this early on with travelers and found that organized oral rehydration solution didn't make it better than if we just told them to drink soups. Soups are wonderful because they are loaded with salt and they have fluid. So broth and soup, saltine crackers, soft drinks. And I think unless you're dealing with cholera, with just purging diarrhea with liters of fluid, which is very, very unusual in this country, just drinking soups, broths, eating saltine crackers and soft drinks, Gatorade, Pedialyte, whatever is available to the person is probably all they need to do with the fluids. Now, the other thing is people need to eat. They need to eat food that is simple, not fried, not greasy, not spicy, but baked, broiled food. The enterocytes of the gut need to regenerate, to heal. And eating food is essential to have that process happen. And 3 meals a day, they can be quite light, is recommended for people that have active diarrhea. Now, the only other thing I would say about that is symptomatic treatment will make people have less stools.
Some patients may benefit from pharmacologic therapy, but one needs to be careful before giving drugs that inhibit diarrhea.
There are two drugs that could be considered. One would be bismuth subsalicylate if people are vomiting, and that seems to be beneficial there. The other is loperamide if people are having watery diarrhea. We worry about loperamide in people with fever or if they're passing bloody stools, but with watery diarrhea, it can help them function, go to school, go to work, take a train or a bus or a plane.
Most cases of persistent diarrhea require a diagnosis in order to direct treatment. If you look at Dr. DuPont's article in the June 28, 2016 issue of JAMA, you'll find several tables of the potential causes and the various treatments for those causes for persistent diarrhea. Because there are so many potential causes of persistent diarrhea, it's desirable to have a single test that can easily identify potential pathogens with one test. Multiplex PCR has the potential, since it can precisely identify any number of organisms in a single test, but has a tendency to produce false positives. So how do we use multiplex PCR in the context of persistent diarrhea?
I'm getting calls from all over the country. What does it mean my patients enter a pathogenic E. coli by multiplex PCR? And I say if it doesn't fit clinically, forget it. I mean, these tests are too sensitive, and we've got to work out the details. And I think that's one of the things that I'm seeing on a national basis that's bothering doctors right now, how to interpret some of those data. You got to be a doctor. You got to be a clinician.
What this means is that there's no single magic test that will give you an answer that leads to a reliable way to treat patients with persistent diarrhea. All of the patient's clinical features need to be considered, and all the test results need to be carefully considered because of the possibility of false positive tests. The trick is to evaluate the patient for the four major aspects of persistent diarrhea. Those four major clinical features are the presence of associated symptoms, exposure history and predisposing factors, a travel history, or stool appearance. The associated symptoms include fever, vomiting, and abdominal pain, and the stool appearance is distinguished by whether or not the diarrhea is watery or has blood or mucus in it. From all of this, one develops an index of suspicion, and if the test results make sense in the context of that index of suspicion, then a treatment plan can be derived. Let's talk briefly about chronic diarrhea. That's diarrhea that lasts more than a month. Start with the history.
So again, the history is very important. So with chronic diarrhea, we start thinking less about infections and more about non-infectious etiologies. So want to know their age, their comorbidities, their medications. That's a big one. A lot of medications can cause side effects of diarrhea. And, you know, just kind of getting an idea again of severity of the diarrhea. So I think that's where I would start.
So what kinds of medications would you be asking about?
A lot of the different psychotropic medications, the psych medications can cause various GI side effects. That's a big one. Metformin is a common cause of diarrhea.
In terms of a chronic diarrhea, what kinds of infectious causes would you be thinking about for long-term diarrhea?
As far as infectious causes, we start thinking more about parasites and some bacteria. So like Aeromonas, Pleomonas, they could cause a more chronic diarrhea that could sometimes be similar to a presentation of inflammatory bowel disease. Giardia, Entamoeba, things like that they can cause more chronic diarrhea.
In your own practice, do you see very much of that here in Texas?
And we've seen a number of cases of Giardia. I've had a patient or two with Aeromonas. It's hard to know because, again, they're my patients with IBD. How much is the IBD? How much is really that infection that we happen to find? But not a ton.
So you see a lot of patients with IBD. So how do they generally present?
So patients with ulcerative colitis often will present with bloody diarrhea, sometimes with or without abdominal pain, weight loss. Patients with Crohn's disease can present a little more varied. So if they have colonic involvement of their Crohn's disease, they may present very similar to UC patients, bloody diarrhea, abdominal pain, weight loss. But patients with Crohn's can also present if they have more ileal disease. They could present with obstructions, or they could present with more watery diarrhea and a lot of abdominal pain. They could present with perianal disease, fistulas, fissures, that kind of thing. So they could present with a number of different symptoms, just given the different nature of Crohn's disease, that transmural inflammation leads to more complications that we don't see with UC.
So if you're thinking inflammatory bowel disease, is the first thing you do a colonoscopy, or how do you evaluate them, or does that vary from patient to patient?
So the first thing I always do with someone that comes in with chronic diarrhea, I still think it's very reasonable to do some stool studies to start off first. Basic stool culture, OMP, and C. diff. And then I also like to get the fecal leukocytes. So now we're getting lactoferrins to look for just for inflammation in the stool. Because once we prep them for the colonoscopy, I don't have any stool anymore. But then I think it's very reasonable to go to colonoscopy.
Again, in your practice here at the VA in Dallas, what do you see most of? Is it Crohn's? Is it ulcerative colitis? Is it something else? What is the most common thing?
It's about half and half, Crohn's and UC.
Anything I'm missing in diarrhea that you think we should talk about or discuss or provide in a podcast to educate people with?
One big thing in our patients with inflammatory bowel disease that's always important to remember, they can have diarrhea not only from – so if they already have a diagnosis of Crohn's or UC, they can have diarrhea not only from active inflammatory bowel disease, but they can have diarrhea from a lot of other causes. So it's always important. One big thing with them when they come in with flare symptoms to look for C. diff. C. diff, while we think about it's usually in our older hospitalized patients or someone who's had recent antibiotics, our patients with inflammatory bowel disease can get C. diff just out in the community without any other risk factors. And we see it very commonly, even more. It seems like it's just been seeing a lot more. And then they can have diarrhea for all kinds of other reasons, bile salt diarrhea, because they've had prior surgeries, or they have bacterial overgrowth, or other things that we need to think about.
So when they flare, do you work them up for everything, or what triggers a workup, and what is that workup?
So typically, I guess it's going to depend on the severity. If it's mild symptoms or just having a little bit of rectal bleeding, maybe we can just – and then again, it depends on where their disease is. But we may be able to do something small and adjunctive like adding some rectal therapy and not do a whole lot of workup. But typically, if they are coming into me complaining of flare symptoms, I always do a set of stool studies first. And then based on that, we'll usually do something empiric, assuming their C. diff is negative, maybe a little course of some Flagyl if they have Crohn's disease or rectal therapy. Or if it's more severe, we may do a course of steroids. Or maybe we can tweak their biologic and give them an extra dose.
An important cause of diarrhea, as well as a host of GI symptoms, is celiac disease.
So celiac is a very common disease that we see a lot. And patients can present very varied. They can present with diarrhea and bloating. They could present with iron deficiency without a whole lot of other symptoms. Some patients may even present with osteoporosis, some of the complications of malabsorption. So they can present a variety of ways. It's also an important thing that we need to look for in our patients with irritable bowel. We do some workup, but one of the things that we found is looking for celiac disease is worth looking for.
How do you work that up?
Typically, we'll start with serologies, like the tissue transglutaminase is the most helpful one, and then maybe getting the endomysial, but definitely the tissue transglutaminase.
Let's say that's positive.
So then I'd have a pretty high suspicion, and I'd want to go ahead and do an endoscopy to get small bowel biopsies to look for villus blunting.
And if you make the diagnosis of celiac, how do you treat that?
Put those patients on a gluten-free diet.
Everybody and his brother these days is on a gluten-free diet. So are physicians recommending that empirically, or is that just something people are doing? Because it's amazing how many people I know now who believe their lives have been absolutely transformed by putting themselves on a gluten-free diet.
And the majority of those people probably do not have celiac disease. That kind of leads on to a different pathway, because a lot of people, when they cut out gluten, cut out a lot of other things, like various fructans and things that are in the same products where wheat is found. And it's those things that are probably giving them symptoms. And then when they cut out gluten, they feel a lot better.
Chronic diarrhea has very different causes than either acute or persistent diarrhea. So when a patient has diarrhea lasting for more than a month, one needs to think about inflammatory bowel disease, celiac disease, or maybe even parasites. The bottom line for persistent diarrhea is that it differs from acute diarrhea because most of the time persistent diarrhea requires a diagnosis and treatment, and most cases of acute diarrhea go away on their own. When evaluating a patient with persistent diarrhea, it's important to find out what symptoms the patient has, such as nausea, vomiting, abdominal pain, and to find out what the patient's exposure history might be, and to find out if they've traveled recently, and to know if the stool is watery or bloody. Patients presenting with abdominal pain and bloody stool should be seriously considered for ischemic bowel disease. If a patient's symptoms have been developed after they've been hospitalized or received antibiotics, C. diff should be considered, even though it causes the diarrhea in only about 10 to 20% of cases. If the persistent diarrhea follows travel to the developing world, then empiric treatment with azithromycin is warranted. Patients with persistent diarrhea who have blood or mucus or watery diarrhea should have a diagnosis established by obtaining pathogen screens through stool cultures, parasite screens, or multiplex PCR. The results of these tests dictate what the appropriate therapy should be, and sometimes these tests need to be repeated until a diagnosis is established. This is Ed Livingston, Deputy Editor of Clinical Reviews and Education for JAMA. I'd like to thank my guests, Dr. Herbert DuPont from the University of Texas at Houston and Dr. Annie Feagins from the University of Texas Southwestern Medical School. I'd also like to thank Lisa Hardin for scheduling our guests and Michelle Krasinski for outstanding editing and production of these podcasts. Stay tuned for further JAMA Clinical Reviews podcasts. You can get these on Stitcher or iTunes, and if you're using iTunes, please subscribe to our podcast and leave us a review. You can also contact me through Twitter using my Twitter handle, @EHLJAMA. You can obtain CME for listening to this podcast and reading Dr. DuPont's review in the June 28, 2016 issue of JAMA. You can get that CME by going to the webpage for that article and taking the CME quiz. Thank you for listening.